Okay, this is tape number 12. It's June 21st, 2000, on Alfred's book.
Shall I get going?
Yeah, you're going.
Okay, the in your midst, even in those days, you know, the glory days of the 50s, there were people amongst us who were older artists, and we kind of sheltered them and praised their work, although we knew that they weren't going to get anywhere. And we would bury them. Grace Church was very graceful. I'm not inventing a pun. They would bury these people.
Grace Church was a person?
Grace Church is the name of a church in Greenwich Village.
Okay.
And it was once an important Episcopal church, I think the first that was set up on the island, you know, preceding St. Patrick's on Fifth Avenue. This is when that part of town was uptown. And the elite would visit Grace Church. And they do to this day. There seems to be a secret service Monday morning. People arrive in Rolls Royces and what have you. And then they leave. But they're very gracious to artists. And I think it's the church that is the most commonly painted in America. Every painter has painted that church out of respect to it. To me, other than Sunday and the glimpse of mysterious people like the Rensselaers and people like this from the first families in New York, the church always seemed deserted on every other day. You have the church and a little rectory beside it. And on my honeymoon, we were traveling with a bulldog. And I wanted to show my wife, Patty, Grace Church in Greenwich Village. And we went walking by it with our bulldog. And a man came bounding out of the rectory. A large kind of vicar you'd see in England, but a large man, and he said, "That bulldog." He said, "My God," said he, "are you going to the bulldoggers at the Taft Hotel?" And I said, "No, we're not." And he said, "Well, that looks like a handsome dog that you have, and I'd like to put in for a puppy." And I was kind of shocked that this is the first time, you know, from these darkened windows, this darkened house, this figure burst forth like an explosion. And I said, "Alas, this dog was cared for by this Dr. Chenkel, who used to teach at the university here, and he let it run free, and I can't guarantee that these would be bulldogs." So our vicar, I call him a vicar, screamed, "Then my God, you'll have to register her as a lewd and lascivious bitch." And I said, "We're not going to do that. We're not in the dog breeding business. We love this dog, and we don't know what we're going to do with the puppies, but we're not. I'm just showing my wife this church, and then we'll be on our way. We're going home to Alaska." But this is the only animated action outside this hotel. Now, I wonder, this is sort of a little note to something, but the question of criticism is, there are people who, if you take a painting to, if they are colleagues or comrades, they're invariably sympathetic to you. And are not really very helpful. Your friends are not helpful. The only thing helpful is that you are comrades and you share resources and things like this. And you do influence one another. And you try to transcend the influence of a veritable horde of people. So then how do you get a criticism? Believe it or not, you'll take it to someone who, they'll say, "If you take this painting to..." to that guy, the guy will go bananas and he'll vomit even. And you've got a great painting, you see. And anyway, there was a critic in Paris. He writes for, I think, Evening Paris, Paris Soir, I forget his name, so long ago. And I took a roll of paintings on my honeymoon to show this guy. And incidentally, when we went through customs, they placed the paintings under seal. And here is France, a foreign country. I'm working in New York. There was an official hostility to our paintings, and they knew my name, and they said,
who?
My name, Alfred Skondovich,
no,
the customs.
They knew your name.
The customs, yeah. And I thought, I'm just an étudiant, a student, you're making mistakes. They said, no, we're not making mistakes. These paintings are under seal, and if you unseal them, then you owe us, some monstrous sum of money. So, but it was my intention. I needed a criticism from this guy. And people said to me, if he goes bananas, if he throws you out of the house, you have got something, you see. So I was not able to see him. So here I am via Alaska and 1,000 miles away. I'm going to see this man in the hope of getting my ass kicked out of his house. And if this would happen, I would be absolutely delirious. I would be on my way. The first time I saw the paintings of Dinero, I might have been hungover, but nonetheless, I'm not seeing work done that way, and I felt like vomiting. You know, I wanted to vomit. I was very embarrassed by the way I felt. And then I realized that this is great painting, and since this is the business of your eyes and senses and your nerve ends and what have you, you know, when you see something that seems so correct, you know, so lyrical, so naturally done, you feel an unworthy challenger. You feel total ignorance. And if you've eaten recently a hamburger or what have you, you feel like throwing up. You feel how... can someone do something like this? How can someone, for instance, over a heavy impasto, place a lyric line? Now, how the hell did he do that? You know, what paint does he use? Ah, he used it house. He used household, but no, he did not. He used paint, and you know, its viscosity. And we're talking not about miniature little paintings where you manifest a control, but a lyric line going, you know, traveling about. 60 inches, you know, it's just incredible, was the work of De Niro. Within a movement of that was changing art forever, and really the formation of a school with people like Picasso, the critics who reviewed his work said, you know, Picasso is finished. This man, Pollock, he is a creature of chaos, but he has repositioned the stars in the sky and everything. This is incredible. But within this movement, there was Gandhi Brody, Gabriel Brody, Robert De Niro, and myself. We never dispense with a figure. Yes, I did purely abstract paintings, you know, along with, but I thought of things that had happened in my life, and I wanted to express them. And frankly, when the attitude of Rockefeller was that this cannot harm us, I don't like someone saying that, you know, art cannot harm me, I'm a powerful man, I'll be yet more powerful because of this sort of dithering, what appears to him to be a dithering, and the work of Siqueiros or the Americans who would do social realistic paintings, or would make heroes out of Zacco and Vanzetti, Ben Shahn. I admire the work of these people, which reminds me of an incident that involved Ben Shahn. Freud said, as involved with the wife of Franz Klein, rather more than Franz Klein.
Here's rather, more than Franz
Klein? Yeah, because emotionally, I thought, my God, here's the sister from the old country. And it's a great comfort when I see her, you know. And in those days, I hated hospitals. And mental institutions were just, I really couldn't abide them, but somehow I learned to cope. Okay, Franz got a teaching job at Black Mountain College. It was something new in colleges where the students voted for the professor, they can continue or get thrown out. It was somewhat revolutionary, and the students also planted tobacco and brought forth these crops and made a little money, you know. People like Bucky, what the hell, Buckminster Fuller would go there, and all these experimental dreams. We would put together buildings in tape and stuff like this. But he was still delving into his theory, and many of these splendiferous dreams collapsed in the wind, you see. However, one day we were told that Ben Shahn was to visit and teach.
We were told, who's we?
The student body.
Were you at Black Mountain?
I was there. France took me there, but I didn't study there. I really had contempt for the whole situation, but not really. The people that were there were people who I'd shown with at the stable at Poindexter, the younger artists, so I enjoyed that very much. And yes, and, you know, Ben Shahn is really a hero to me. I feel he's a person who could picture the atrocities and the evil that men could do to men, you know. And then on the day he was to arrive, there were two volunteers to pick him up. God, Cy Twombly and Robert Rauschenberg. And no suspicion was attached to this. They could drive and they were very handy. Like most city boys, I really couldn't drive. And they went down to the railroad station to pick up Ben Shahn. But no one returned to the school. We thought, we called the police and wondered if there was a car in a ditch. They said no. And then a day later, a bedraggled Ben Shahn arrived at the school with Robert Rauschenberg and Cy Twombly. And he told a story that was dismaying. It was really the convergence of two ways of looking at the picture of a new space, you see, of so-called plasticity, you know, this new aesthetic, letting it all hang out. And they captured Ben Shahn and took him to this cabin, and they seated him on this stool, and Rauschenberg unrolled a painting that was about, that encompassed the entire area. He unrolled the goddamn thing, and it went all around Ben Shahn. And I don't know what the subject matter was, you know. It was probably something like Bauer's painting. Bauer, when the Baroness Hiller, I don't want to get off course here, but they said to Shahn, this is what's happening, you see. And you're finished, and you're through, you see. Take a look at this. Can you do this? You should try, you know, but you're going to waste your time coming up here if you think you are going to teach us anything, you see. And they brainwashed him, and they spoke to him, and this nightmare for this aging man went on all through the night. And finally they brought him up there, you see, and this was towards the end of that semester, and the students liked Franz Kline all right, and they had a gift for him. He would wear tennis sneakers, in which there were slits that would from which carbuncles or cores would appear. And anyway, students were, there's always an upper middle class caste to all of these students anyway. When you scratch a revolutionary, there's a, you know, the son of a CEO of a major company, you know. It's like the time Poindexter, we went down to Cuba. He was looking for a retirement place, and there was an acreage in Cuba, and two nice young people in a jeep picked us up at the airport. And Rockefeller, that was a Freudian slip, he would do the same thing. He would use me as a front to be investigated, and would appear to be, in reality, upon a bit quite poor. And we were the ones who would look at the land. And
we
do. There was another guy involved in this, his controller of commodity brokers. But anyway, the guy who met us was Raul and Fidel Castro, who wanted to sell, but the lot they had was 15,000 acres. And they introduced themselves as salesmen, and we said, no, this is too much. Mr. Poindexter is retiring, and he is not going to handle 15,000 acres. And of course, 2 years later, Mr. Castro would have seized the land.
Well, this was 1958.
Before that.
Oh, before that. I don't
before that. Yeah, I'm merely going across borders. This was in, I think, 51. He smuggled me down
Castro,
there.
He came with, okay,
around that time.
He smuggled you. How'd you get down there without a
God only knows. People think that I did jobs for Poindexter, Admiral Poindexter, who took over the National Security Agency, but I did not.
But you had no passport.
No, I didn't have it. I had a seaman's paper and a British passport, and we were in a private plane now to conduct business, and we landed and met these very pleasant people, and we took off because it wasn't what George wanted. He went to Tortola, but I didn't want to go there because the issue of passports would come up. And to legitimize my stay, Poindexter was designing shows called Five Americans. Now it's in a show called Five Americans. Or Ten Americans, you know.
Okay, Ten Americans was held in 1955.
Oh, yeah.
So this must have been after that.
No, this was the incident with Mr. Castro was before then.
Okay, but Poindexter getting into designing shows with Five Americans
was to help me.
That was after the 5-10 Americans show.
Yeah, that was.
So we're talking about two different times.
Yeah, two different times. I was in with 5 younger Americans because the new manager of Poindexter Gallery had kind of displaced me and put me amongst where I felt that I didn't belong. Mm-hmm. Although Dan Rice and Cidio Frombaluti and people like that, you know, they're all right, I suppose, but they don't compare to who I felt that I should show with and who I showed with. That's Franz Kline and William de Kooning, see. We're talking about the imprisonment of Ben Shahn, and I was in that very, very much. I really never spoke to Rauschenberg after that, you know. And yet, I was in a show at the Stable Gallery. The Stable Gallery, New York. And the show was the Salon du Refusé. That is what the Metropolitan Museum refused, wound up in the Stable Gallery. The Stable Gallery was kind of interesting because it was once a horse stable, and which had been converted into a gallery. The only other horse stable, and there were horse stables near Central Park, of course, where people go up and down that rotten row, is it called?
That's and in Britain.
Well, there'd be an equivalent in Central Park that apes that. Anyway, Rauschenberg said you should ban this. I said no. I said something very embarrassing happened. I had to go to this laboratory that was kind of new in this sort of thing, where that had a rabbit test to find out if your girlfriend is pregnant. And I was there, and the lady who owns the Stable Gallery was there, and I don't want to go anywhere near her. You understand? He said, yeah, I understand. So he says, why don't you give me an 8.5 by 11 painting, and I'll put it behind a door. When they open the door of my painting, they'll see a Skontovich, you see? So you don't have to see the lady. So I said, okay. So that was really the last business I had with him. When we were in Rome, we didn't succeed in seeing Cy Twombly. I knocked on the door of the place where he lived. We saw Wolf Kahn in Rome. We saw John Hunter in Rome. But we didn't succeed in seeing Cy Twombly, who had married an Italian princess and was really living the right life of Riley. So I didn't get along with these tests. But really, that thing where they kidnapped Ben Shahn and gave him a lecture upon the future was pretty much sort of a thing. After these moving around, we would go out to, for some reason we would meet, Franz Klein and I would meet.
This was still at Black Mountain?
No, now home from Black Mountain.
Back in the building.
Yeah, grateful students of Franz Klein gave him a pair of new tennis shoes, which he hated and refused to wear. And the bastards had thrown away his old tennis sneakers. And the most work I ever did at Black Mountain was searching through the garbage dump for Franz Klein's treasured tennis shoes. And then we arrived back in New York, and then I had to explain to Elizabeth that he was not involved in any extracurricular affairs or extramarital affairs. I was the only one who could give her this assurance. I used to meet, when I worked in the garment industry, central to the garment industry was the intersection where there were two great stores, Gimbel's to the south and Macy's to the north. And on the ground floor were franchised businesses like Needix, and some place with a lot more Needix and Dunkin' Donuts or something like that. And I would meet friends there, and we'd head over to New Jersey to see Elizabeth. And on one occasion after the Black Mountain episode, I was waiting for him, and he turned up. But the Avenue, they had a veterans of foreign wars were parading. And the New Yorkers, you know, the natives hated these bastards because they would have cattle prods and get up to all sorts of things, you know. They would be drunk, and raising hell, and
cattle prod.
This is an electrical thing. This is one of the favorite implements of the Americans of veterans of foreign wars, you see, and so on and so forth. They would pull all sorts of crap like this. And anyway, Franz turns up, and we walk to the, we're on the sidewalk now, and we're heading for the subway to take the shuttle over to New Jersey. And people started shouting, who were in the parade, "It's Franz! Franz!" And here were guys from his hometown in Pennsylvania that he went to high school with. And they had the hats and jackets and stuff like that. And Franz says, "You go over there and see Elizabeth. These are people. I'm going to march with them." All this happened in a matter of 30 seconds. Men were marching in cadence, and they recognized a whole phalanx of men, said, "Franz, yes, there he is." And he joined them and marched with them, and then became indistinguishable. I thought, where is he? And I couldn't see him anymore. It was just, it returned, you know, to wherever the hell he came from, Altoona, Pennsylvania. And then I went over to see Elizabeth. Well, art was really kind of a ragtaggle thing that was not approved of by my parents, who were really involved in a struggle for survival. Immigrants who fled a revolution. They were people who never became citizens and were stateless, you see. And I had two brothers who were stateless citizens. One brother, when he fought in France, the French government arrested him as a deserter. Governments take an interest in international bouts that involve their pugilists and help in every way they can. But if my brother was a deserter, he was all of 3 years of age when he left for England, you see. And art did not fit into this game of survival, you know. My brothers did well in boxing and went into other things. They went into, they represented artists, entertainers. A publishing company grew up. There was a tailoring company that prospered. The publishing company concerned itself with union people, you know. It was my stepbrothers ran that. And in the with the death of my father, they kind of seized these assets, you know.
This was must have been after you had left England.
Yes, yeah. But, you know, art, to be a painter was, this is not how you survive, you know. This is how you, you know, surrender to the fate. And this is not the way to carry on. And then what comes naturally to you? Like, I understand that if I went to school and studied mechanical engineering, I understood mechanical engineering and what my deficits are and what I could do. And the little that I learned put bread and butter on the table in this house when I worked as a surveying engineer, you see. Yeah. And even in the village when I would, you know, apart from tailoring, I was working a lathe and a milling machine in this guy's bathroom, for some rogue scientist working on this atomic goddamn thing. But art, this is for the rich, you see.
You felt that way? It was a part of how you, I mean, looking in the back there?
Yeah, this is something for rich people.
I want to make that clear. But this wasn't just how your parents felt, it was kind of how it echoed in you too.
It echoed in me too. I thought that I'm letting everyone down, letting down my flesh and blood. it is difficult to describe England to you, but when my, and of course things have changed, as I've explained, you know, the that Jack Straw is now in power, and the farmer I called the people, you know, the members of the family, Master, Master John and Master Richard, and Mistress Gough, who he didn't marry. This is relentless, and it's a, you know, and there's a certain charm to all of this, however, you know. But it kind of puts you in a certain place, you know. And you have to seek the patronage of these people. I had Lady Ursula Bullard, Lady Violet Bonham Carter, and Lady Basil Henriques, who offered to help in this regard, you see. So if I'd stayed there, things would have brightened up for me, you know. For all the time I felt, you know, I'm someone who called John Master John. When we went to England on our honeymoon and we visited the old farm, Master John had died. What a shock that was. And the young guy who said, no, we don't call people Master anymore here. And he said that he took over the farm, that John had died. So I went back in time to discover that time had...
It was gone.
Has gone, yeah.
Right. You were living in the village.
No.
I
didn't feel that I was amongst... I was amongst people who actually put bread on their table, you see, and who were doing great things.
With art.
With art. And... I thought, this country is different. You know, I don't need a royal patron. I don't have to move up. But this country was different. And the playing field was level, you might say, you know. Even though it was level and people can take pot shots at you and throw earth, mud, fire and water, you accepted this punishment in good company, you see, in good company, and you saw things change. You changed the world in which you live. Incredible, incredible! I can't believe it. I did something that came naturally. Then, and then I went to the Hoffman School, and went a step beyond this, you know. I thought that the work of De Niro was done naturally, but it was, and yet there was something else.
What?
That he added to this.
What?
If one has a natural attribute, you know, you're involved in a form of primitivity, but he kind of transcended that. That is, the paintings had a universal appeal, you see. This was painted in a language one knew would be understood throughout the world, you see.
In some way. I mean, by saying understood...
Yeah,
meaning
there's an internet, there's a language that you're speaking with this thing called a paintbrush.
It's visual.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm asking you to say it, that's all. I mean, yeah, I'm not ready to say
it. It's a visual thing. No longer parochial, which was once, you know, the centerleaf of your eccentricity, but it's something that reaches out to the world. And that was the quality of De Niro, you see. And to me, he was quite heroic. He believed in art for art's sake. And believing in art for art's sake was you chose a very incorrect path with that attitude.
Why? What do you mean by that?
He believed that you shouldn't politic in art. Like Pollock believed that you should never talk about art. Never lecture about art. Never cooperate with art historians. Keep your mouth shut and just do this thing. That was his belief.
And De Niro?
And De Niro felt the same way about this.
So what's the
and he had a coda of struggle, of starving if necessary.
Sacrifice,
yeah. But I had a number of agendas that I was carrying. I was teaching people boxing at the New York Athletic Club. You have to be fit for this. You have to eat. And, you see, or be punished. I mean, literally, you know. Sometimes I find myself in De Niro's studio. And I would feel hungry. My body would tell me that I'd have to perform that evening. And I'd need food. And I checked the refrigerator. There'd be nothing there except sardines that you could you suspect were old. And I'd say, Jesus Christ, there's no fucking food here, Bob. And he said, don't worry, this is America, and we will be fed, you see. And then almost on the money, on the dot, a young lady would appear. They invite us out to dinner, you see. And he'd look at me as if to say, you see what I mean? This is America. We don't starve. We're not, you know, these European children. We, you know, our parents, you know, the poor little children in Europe, they don't get their daily
grunt. How did it strike you?
I thought someone would turn up. That you
right. Well, I mean, this must have been...
I said, Bob, I can't depend upon this.
Right.
I can't depend upon this. I really have to eat.
You have to take care. No,
I had to take care of myself,
yeah,
because I had to work.
Yeah.
I had to work. You know.
Survival.
Yeah. I wasn't exactly surviving. I would arrive and I was supporting a whole bunch of people here, from Franz Kline to Robert De Niro,
okay.
You know.
You were, but, can you say more about that?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
I mean that I fell into a job where I got a union salary.
Garment.
Yeah, in the garment industry. And the beauty of it was I'd work during winter on coats and suits, and then the season would end in late spring, so I'd go off to summer school in Provincetown.
Oh.
See, it was wonderful.
You were helping financially other people like Franz Kline and
yeah.
Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
Tell me something about that. How did you do that? Would you just buy them food or pay their rent or what?
I buy them food.
You pay the, like, let's go eat, and you'd pay for it. Something
yeah.
Like that.
Okay. Yeah, that's how it was. Or I just give them money.
You know what this sounds like to me? I mean, I think of you in being bombed in
yeah.
England, and thinking about survival, and thinking about how to survive, mm-hmm. and that would always be a basic issue for you, that you would have to... That art would be something...
Where we were, where the bombing had continued, you see. There was, at one time, to talk about the bombing continued, there was an organization amongst the artists they called themselves the Black Hand, you see. This is also a name for the mafia. They called themselves the Black Hand. And these artists came together
in New York.
In New York. In the late 40s and early 50s. And if they didn't like a criticism of their work by someone out of Bryn Mawr on the New York Times, if he was a man, they'd beat the shit out of him.
Really?
Really, yeah. So, a latter-day painter who was Norman Bloom. And Norman kind of did Norman Bloom, B-L-U-H-M, don't mix him up with the other guy named Bloom from 15th Street, who did realistic, you know, social realistic work, Norman Bloom.
Norman did social realistic work?
No. He did small abstract. And whereas you have the heroic gestures and the choreography of Jackson Pollock, this guy would have a paintbrush and go, and you know, and it was kind of a miniaturization of that kind of work. But Norman got the most wonderful reviews, you see, beyond simply because Norman would collar some reviewer and beat the living shit out of him, see. You beat up one and all the others get the message and the reviews, you see. So that was Norman Bloom. He was the continuation of the old Black Hand, that where they would beat up reviewers. But then he was rendered obsolescent by history, where millions of dollars were thrown at these people, you know. And with one of these people.
I want to talk about it, I'm not sure, but I become interested in how you thought about things, like how, where you placed art, and how come you were working. These other that decides for you some things about art, how important it will be to you, how much you'll believe in it, or go for it. Will that affect you?
Yeah. You know, I have this gift and I really can't live without it. I might forget about it or not do it, but it's the only thing that makes me whole.
And on the other hand, you're taking care of other people, too.
Yeah.
As though that's something you should do, or they need you, being friends, clients.
I had no option. That's what you had to do.
So that would put your gift,
yeah,
your
this need. Is what we were like. This is people help one another. You had a job, and that's what you were expected to do.
But other people didn't have jobs. Is that right?
They had jobs like framing or matting paintings. They had jobs like painting houses. That's what de Kooning did for years. That's what Franz Klein did for years, you know. Or doing murals in cafes and restaurants in New Jersey.
But you didn't do that kind of work.
No, I just did tailoring, taught boxing.
Which is
built organ boxes, did lathe and milling work on the potentiometer, you see.
So your work in some way took you away from art or painting.
Yeah.
Whereas their work kind of kept them in the new you.
Yeah. I couldn't make the sacrifice that these people would make.
Why not? Why do you think?
I don't like starving. I just don't like the idea of starving.
Right.
When these were wonderful days, blah, 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 but there were people who went mad. There were people who committed suicide. It was it's a stressful thing to change the way people see things.
What do you mean by that? Change the way people see things?
I mean that when people look at paintings, they really look at dead things. You know, they look at here the beloved art is you know, is a cabin and moose turds and stuff like that. You grasp it just once. I guess your house might grasp it at once and thereafter it becomes a dead thing on the wall. It doesn't seem to live or breathe. It doesn't have, you know, something infinite about it. This is what people like.
Something that's dead.
Something that is dead.
They can just hang there and...
Right, yeah. That is non-controversial. They don't have to think. They like that sort of thing, so you piss around with that, and you know, and the Academy is dead. Long live the Academy. You know, even I'm called old-fashioned by people. What the hell is all that about? You know, and I turn on my heel and I do something new. But there are people who don't like that. There are nations who have dead things on the wall, you know. And you know, you mess around with that, and it is not liked at all. The Academy that we fought in New York was fair enough. It was Picasso and Matisse and Duchamp who joined our ranks and played chess for 30 or 40 years. Mongraviti, Peppino Mongraviti, the head of the art department at Columbia, said that Castle and